my fellow Americans. It is I, George W. Bush. And I must say that I realize many Americans, they feel that we're stuck in perilous times. But I feel in the past few months alone, I have done a good job at reducing the perilousness. For example, back in the month of November, I flew over to Iraq to surprise the troops for Thanksgiving. It was wonderful to be there. It was wonderful to serve the troops dinner. It's wonderful to talk to the troops one-on-one. And of course, it was truly wonderful to be so close to the land where Thanksgiving all began. Now, my wife is under the impression that Thanksgiving began here. But everybody knows it began in Turkey. And now, my fellow Americans, I hope you will excuse me for just a moment. I need to make a secure, very important phone call in the name of national security. 10-10-220.
Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
This is George W. Bush. This is Saddam there.
What? W?
Saddam?
W, is that you? I can't hear. I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I've got a bad connection. I'm on cell phone. You know, I'm in a cell. I'm on a phone. What can I say?
So, Saddam, I heard we caught you living in a hole with rats and stuff.
Yeah, well, you should know what that's like. You do live in Washington, D.C. Hmm? Yeah, but seriously, W, why would you do such a thing to me? I'm the duly elected leader of my country. I got the majority of the votes.
You sound like Al Gore. Look, Saddam, I have half a mind.
I've
just
heard. Yeah.
And I'm not going to stop with you. I'm going to get the rest of the guys on my list of axis of evil-ers.
What? You mean like Kim Jong-il?
Well, I was thinking more like former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, but, you know, whatever.
Look, W, listen, man. You have to understand why I'm so upset at you. You pull me out of my hole, and the first thing I discover is that I missed Ryan and Trista's wedding, and now I can't get a flu shot. And on top of everything else, I discover I'm Strom Thurmond's love child. Oh, wait, I have to let you go. I've got you on call Kuwaiting. Well, I may have been captured, but at least now I have a theme song. Spider hole, I've been living just like a troll. Underground, laying flat, crawling round like a rat. Look out, I'm from a spider hole. Filthy bed, but sex was nice. I'm a stud if compared to mice. Watch me run for my life to avoid my ex-wife. Way down, down in that spider hole. U.S. troops at last had uncovered my trench. I surrendered fast, so they think I was French. Ah! It's so mean, it's obscene. I'm splashed all over each TV screen. Now Saddam is destroyed. Bush is so overjoyed. But who can that man with that big frown be? He's not so glad you found me. You'll find it's Howard Dean.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Best Hope for a Sustainable Future on Earth. Alan Weissman shows how education, women's equality, and family planning can curb poverty, thirst, hunger, and environmental destruction. Alan makes a strong case for slowing global population growth as a prerequisite for achieving a sustainable future.
So you mentioned access to contraceptives and education for women as being pretty key elements. Is there anything that those of us as Americans should know about that or might want to contribute? We're already near replacement rate here, but maybe there's things we can help with projects around the world.
The most important thing, you know, country after country, I found that you don't need to get government involved. This is an individual decision. In Iran, you know, they told people, have as many children as you want, but, you know, people got the idea. I go to the Vatican in this book, and we all know the Vatican's position on this, and the Vatican, frankly, can't change that position because it would, they're painted into a corner called papal infallibility. And please, if there's any Catholics in the room, I mean no offense here, because I had interesting conversations there. You can read all about them. And also one of my great mentors in life was a Catholic priest, and he's also in the book. But the Vatican, which is this country that's 110 acres, population 1,000, nearly all of them males, is surrounded by this other Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet because Italian women are some of the best educated on the planet. I think per capita more graduate degrees there among females than anywhere else. And you know, they just simply don't pay attention to the Vatican's position on that, nor do Catholics in the United States. 98% of Catholic women in the United States have either used or are currently using contraception. So there's a case of just, you know, of a country that didn't even have a program, but fertility came way down. But it takes getting contraception out there. And one of the things that I follow a lot of people in this book, in Africa and in the Philippines and places, who are getting contraception out to people. And sometimes they have to do real end runs around their government, or they simply have to raise the money by themselves to do it. In the Philippines, you got all these fishing villages where they've realized, hey, we live on fish. 90% of the protein in a Filipino's diet is fish. This is how we make our living. But if we become so numerous that we outnumber the fish stocks, it's all over. So even though the Philippine government, which is one of the few places where the church is really powerful, doesn't have a national policy, all these little villages do. But getting the contraception to them, this, I was surprised to find, is all financed by a relatively few Western governments and by about four major foundations, and those are all from the United States. Bill and Melinda Gates is number one. I'm pleased to say that the United States is the biggest contributor to funding by far, more than all the rest of them put together, of contraception out there, and that it's done very intelligently. When I was in Pakistan, there are all these USAID-promoted family planning, you know, access to tools programs, and they take off that little phrase that says gift of the American people, USAID, because that's not going to fly in some of the really conservative parts of Pakistan. Please listen to this, because this is the thing that you can do. The funding for this worldwide to make contraception available to everybody who wants it. And by the way, in Countdown, I do talk about the new male contraceptives that are coming online, which purport to be very, very simple and successful. To make contraception available so everybody can choose whether to use it worldwide would cost about $8.1 billion a year. Now, that's not very much money. That's less than the United States was spending, your tax dollars and mine, per month in Afghanistan and Iraq during most of the last decade. I mean, this is really affordable. But it's also really fragile, because the population projections that we have right now, which aren't pretty, we're at 7.2 billion now, and we're headed to 9.5 billion by the middle of the century and to just about 11 billion by the end of the century. That means the amount of contraception that we currently are making available. I'm not a member of a political party, but if Obama's opponents would have won that last election, Romney and Ryan made it pretty clear that they were going to cut a lot of that U.S. funding for this stuff. A half a child more per woman in the world, we would be headed to $16 billion by the end of the century. But a half a child fewer, which would happen if we made contraception universally available, we would be headed to $6 billion by the end of this century. That's a huge difference. That's taken us back in the direction of sustainability. And lest anyone, maybe I'm preempting a question here, but the relationship between contraception and abortion always comes up. Half of all pregnancies, not just in the world, but in this country, are unintended. So people seek abortions. I went to a lot of countries where abortions are illegal, and there's still a lot of abortions going on. 40 million a year in the world. Several demographic institutes have calculated that if contraception was universally available so people could use it if they chose, the number of abortions would drop to 14 million a year. That's still a lot of abortions, but that's 36 million fewer. That's the best anti-abortion program I've ever heard. So.
Well, now, you've given us a lot of historic detail as well as science in the book, and I think you're kind of catching that just even from the discussion, what he's talking about here. But I wanted to go back to, you started off in Jerusalem, in the Holy Land, by three major religions. So, you know, $8 billion a year to stabilize global population sounds like a great idea. It doesn't sound that hard to reach given our global economy. But religion, is that an important element that's getting in the way? Or?
Well, you know, some of you might have seen me on television last night. I was on the Bill Maher show, and, you know, religion is his big bugaboo, and he thinks that it's the cause of all the problems. And my response to him is that, look, it's not really just about religion. It's about tribalism. This is the history of, chimpanzees or primates before us. Everyone wants to be fruitful and multiply to outnumber your competitors, so you don't, you know, the Israelites wanted to be put, you know, to be more numerous than the Canaanites. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were all polygamists. That's, you know, for the same reason the Mormons were later on. It's a strategy to have a lot of kids, so you are the biggest group on the block. But, you know, it's the law of diminishing returns. Too much of a good thing suddenly becomes too much, or things change on you. Very interesting in the Bible that you get to the fourth generation, and one of Jacob's 13 kids, Joseph, who may be the first ecologist in recorded history that we have, because he's very observant, and he realizes that the world is entering a time of scarcity. And he has only one wife and just two children, and he counsels the Pharaoh of Egypt and the Israelites. And according to Talmudic scholars, the rule was, in times of famine, you don't have babies. And, you know, but he basically tells the Pharaoh, you know, this is not a time to be expanding. This is a time to be conserving. You know, it's a time of urgency. And frankly, I think that we're in one of those times of urgency right now. I found, you know, in all the religions, you know, we know Catholicism's situation, but on the other hand, Catholics are doing what they choose to do when they have the means and the education to know. Buddhists, there's a chapter in Thailand, this Buddhist country, where again an economist realized that the country was never going to develop economically because all the villages were overflowing with kids. So he started passing condoms out in development meetings. Everybody looked at him like he was like, what are you doing? And it wasn't working. And one day he was talking to a room about this size, and as he's talking about family planning and getting all these blank stares, he's unconsciously unwrapping the condom, and then suddenly this thing droops, and, you know, just like you, everybody starts to giggle, and then he realizes he's got their attention, so he does what every boy has done at one point, and he blows the thing up, and just like you, everybody is suddenly roaring, and then he hands condoms out, and he has a condom blowing up contest, and he starts doing this all over Thailand, and he gets the Buddhist monks to sprinkle holy water on the condoms, and this picture gets faxed to all the media, and suddenly Thailand, which is a country that has a sex industry as one of its economic pillars, you know, he just went to them, and he didn't say, you guys are sinners, you have to stop doing that. He says, look, you guys have a business, AIDS is coming up, do you want to be known as a business that makes your clients sick? Here's the answer. Thailand is now below replacement rate. So you can use sometimes religion as your ally. Every religion has got an opportunity to conserve. It's in Ecclesiastes, refraining from embracing at times.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. President Jimmy Carter speaks to the nation on a growing energy crisis in 1979.
What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never. From now on, every new addition to our demand for energy will be met from our own production and our own conservation. The generation-long growth in our dependence on foreign oil will be stopped dead in its tracks right now, and then reversed as we move through the 1980s. For I am tonight setting the further goal of cutting our dependence on foreign oil by one half by the end of the next decade, a saving of over 4.5 million barrels of imported oil per day. Point two, to ensure that we meet these targets, I will use my presidential authority to set import quotas. I'm announcing tonight that for 1979 and 1980, I will forbid the entry into this country of one drop of foreign oil more than these goals allow. These quotas will ensure a reduction in imports even below the ambitious levels we set at the recent Tokyo summit. I ask Congress to give me authority for mandatory conservation and for standby gasoline rationing. To further conserve energy, I'm proposing tonight an extra $10 billion over the next decade to strengthen our public transportation systems. And I'm asking you, for your good and for your nation's security, to take no unnecessary trips, to use carpools or public transportation whenever you can, to park your car one extra day per week, to obey the speed limit, and to set your thermostats to save fuel. Every act of energy conservation like this is more than just common sense. I tell you, it is an act of patriotism. Our nation must be fair to the poorest among us. So we will increase aid to needy Americans to cope with rising energy prices. We often think of conservation only in terms of sacrifice. In fact, it is a most painless and immediate way of rebuilding our nation's strength. Every gallon of oil each one of us saves is a new form of production. It gives us more freedom, more confidence, that much more control over our own lives. So the solution of our energy crisis can also help us to conquer the crisis of the spirit in our country. It can rekindle our sense of unity, our confidence in the future, and give our nation and all of us individually a new sense of purpose. I have seen the strength of America in the inexhaustible resources of our people. In the days to come, let us renew that strength in the struggle for an energy-secure nation. In closing, let me say this. I will do my best, but I will not do it alone. Let your voice be heard. Whenever you have a chance, say something good about our country. With God's help and for the sake of our nation, it is time for us to join hands in America. Let us commit ourselves together to a rebirth of the American spirit. Working together with our common faith, we cannot fail. Thank you and good night.
And now back to The Best Hope for a Sustainable Future on Earth with Alan Weissman.
And I have to say, you do cover a lot of religions in here and do show us those. Some of us from the Catholic background might think of them as loopholes, but, you know, I think they're ways around what we think they're saying.
You know, religion is just something that we human beings do. You know, it's come up all over the world. And rather than try to tell people, you know, that's fiction, that's poppycock, you know, try to change their beliefs, I just try to find ways to show that it's in your belief. You know, even the Mormons actually have a history of this thing, because when polygamy was outlawed in the United States, they were still trying to be fruitful and multiply, and suddenly a lot of Mormon women were dying in childbirth because they were getting pregnant too fast. Fortunately, Mormons really emphasized education, and there was a new generation of Mormon doctors. This was around the turn of the century, and they started advising women that for the sake of our culture, which is family-oriented, and for the sake of you and your family, you have to start spacing your births. So when I was in Utah talking about this thing, I would say things like, you know, you guys are way ahead of the rest of us who are tied to these thousands of year old liturgies, because you have our modern religion with your modern treatise, the Book of Mormon, and you already did the right thing once to save the mother, and now there's Mother Nature that we might have to save. So I sold a lot of books.
And speaking of Mother Nature, you provide some really good examples, some juxtapositions of how local growing populations are affecting local species such as mountain gorillas in Uganda, the African giraffe in Niger, elephants in India. And you also point out that it's really hard to tell when we've overrun the species and animals are going extinct. At what point does it become important? And I just, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a little passage from your book that relates to that. And I think it shows some nice detail that I've been highlighting here. So this is in China, in the Mao generation, mid-century. During the Great Leap Forward, Chairman Mao declared war on China's ubiquitous Eurasian tree sparrow because it ate grain. For 4 years, people hunted sparrows with slingshots, tore down their nests, and banged pots and pans when they alighted to scare them back into the sky until they finally fell dead from exhaustion. Only after millions were exterminated and the species reached the brink of extinction did anyone connect the swarms of locusts devouring the country's rice to the missing sparrows. Eurasian sparrows, it turned out, were the locust's principal natural predator. The years in which the sparrows were absent from China's ecosystem, not surprisingly, were also the years of the Great Famine that killed 30 to 40 million people. I wonder if you could speak some more to the role of animals.
Well, it's really significant to understand that this is, you know, the four questions that I mentioned in the beginning that basically this book boiled down to: how many people, how much nature, are there alternatives that are culturally acceptable, and how do we do an economy that can prosper without growth? That question about how much nature, nobody can answer. That's a scientific experiment. You just start pulling things out of the ecosystem and wait to see when does it crash. And unfortunately, one of the reasons that environmental issues get attacked by deniers all the time, like climate deniers, is that you can't use the scientific experiment on the environment because we all live in the environment. We can't escape it. There was a noble but feeble attempt up north of here at Biosphere 2, and it was quite instructive. So we're all part of this experiment. And the only way we're going to know what's truly essential to us is when we lose it. Paul and Ann Ehrlich, in one of their later books, they have a little story which I replicate in here. And there are several other stories, but there's this kind of the quickest one. It's a story that they call the rivet poppers, and it's become kind of a classic in ecological understanding. Some guy's getting on a plane, and he noticed there's a mechanic sitting up on the wing, and he's popping rivets out of the wing. And he says to him, "Hey, what are you doing, man?" And he says, "Removing rivets." And he says, "What are you doing that for?" He says, "Well, the company found that they can resell them, and there's so many in there, you know, that, you know, it's you know, it doesn't seem to be a problem. The wing hasn't fallen off yet." So, well, so here we are, folks, you know. Our presence on this planet is so huge. You know, this stuff about food production.
When the rich man on the TV said this world's mine, when he asked which side you're on, told you to step in line. Flag in your window, and buy the goods that you were sold, or did you shut off this craven image? Call the man a liar. Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Skin, clerks and teachers, engineers with names like Sammy and Mazin. When they were breaking down the doors, taking them away, holding them on secret charges, hidden from the light of day, what did you tell their children? When you had a chance to meet, could you look them in the eye? Or did you walk past them on the street? Could you say that you stood up when their lives were on the wire? Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire?
door when the fascist state was here. And they brought home the war when the Gestapo was in the city. And they had really taken power when there was nothing left to do. Here in the final hour, did you find a place to run to? And hope to live a few more years when the slaughter was around you. Did you cover up your ears? Or did you set your sights? Take your aim and fire. Did you strike a blow against the empire? Did you strike a blow against the empire?
Now for something completely different.